Good morning. Whether you're joining us online or here in this sanctuary, welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, Texas. We are a spiritual community dedicated to a free and responsible search for truth, meaning, and beauty. I'm the Reverend Michelle LeGrave, the interim co-lead minister here. I'm a white, middle-aged woman with super short hair, maybe a little shorter than planned yesterday, wearing a ministerial stole, and my pronouns are she, her. It is a joy to be with all of you today. I especially want to welcome you if you are new to this or any church, and to congratulate you all for being here on this morning when it's daylight savings time and South by Southwest, and yet you're here. Yay! If you are joining us remotely, and if you can, please say hello in the comments and let us know from where you are viewing the service. We invite you to fill out the online visitor form at austinuu.org. Simply click on worship, which will then show you a link to the form. We would love to get to know you better. Whoever you are, wherever you come from, wherever you find yourself on your life's journey, whichever your pronouns, whatever your abilities or disabilities, whether you've walked in or rolled in or tuned in, whomever you love, you are welcome here. You belong here. We come from a long tradition of seeing a spark of the divine in every person. It's in this tradition, this living tradition, that I invite you to greet the holy among us, either in the comments or by turning to those around you. Let us greet each other now.
Good morning. I'm Angela Smith, pronouns she, her, and I'm happy and honored to be your lay leader today. I'm a short, 4'11", feisty white woman who flunked Jell-O making in seventh grade home ec. I knew then you would never catch me in a kitchen cooking or making a rebuttal speech. Would you join me now in reading the words for the chalice lighting? This is the flame we hold in our hearts as we strive for justice for everyone. This is the light we shine upon systems of oppression until they are no more. This is the warmth we share with one another as our struggle becomes our salvation. Our call to worship. We seekers are on a quest to discover truth and meaning. Sometimes we think we found it, wrapped up, glimmering with newness, straight off the intellectual assembly line. All the answers right here for us, and others, if only they'd listen. But truth has a way of coming in disguise, sometimes wearing rags, and sometimes finery, but so often cloaked from our immediate sight. And sometimes that which we have rejected, that which we have let go of, or decided was only for others, but not for us, can be our teacher. Let our time of worship be an acknowledgement of the never-ending journey toward truth and meaning, and our appreciation of those we learn from along the way.
One of the things that binds First UU together as a religious community is that the congregation has a common purpose. For First UU of Austin, that common purpose is the mission. The congregation wrote it together and put it up on the wall in the sanctuary in big, beautiful letters. And every Sunday we say it together so that we may more readily carry it with us in our hearts throughout the week. Let us say it together now. Together we nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice to build the beloved community. Now is the time in our service for the story for all ages, and I would like to invite anyone who is young or young at heart or likes to throw things to come on up onto the chancel here. So I'm going to remind you of a story that you might actually already know. It's a story about starfish. So here's how it goes. One day, a person was walking along the beach next to the ocean, and she saw the beach completely covered with all of these starfish. All these starfish had washed up on the beach, and the sun was shining, and it was hot, and they were out of the water where they didn't belong, and they were starting to dry out. And if nothing was done, all the starfish were going to die. So if you saw this, just think for a moment, what do you think you would do? Probably try to get them back in the ocean? Oh, get some friends to help, and then you could cover even more area. Yeah. So this person who was walking on the beach, she saw all these starfish, and she kind of felt hopeless. She thought, there's so many here. There's no way I can save them all. And she was really tempted to just give up and save none of them. And then she walked a little farther and she saw another person standing at the end of the beach where it meets the ocean. And he was picking up starfish and flinging them into the ocean one by one. So she asked him what he was doing and why he was even trying to bother to save all these starfish, because it was an impossible task. And you know what he said? Because it matters to this one. And he picked up another starfish and threw it into the ocean. So we may not be able to change the whole world. We may not be able to save the whole world. But it makes a difference to every one little thing. For every little thing that we can do, right?
Our reading is from The Web of Life by Robert Weston. There is a living web that runs through us to all the universe, linking us each with each and through all life on to the distant stars. Each knows a little corner of the world and lives as if this were his all. We no more see the further reaches of the threads than we see of the future, yet they're there. Touch but one thread, no matter which. The thoughtful eye may trace to distant lands its firm continuing strand, yet lose its filaments as they reach out, but find at last it coming back to him from whom it led. We move as in a fog, aware of self, but only dimly conscious of the rest, as they are close to us in sight or feeling. New objects loom up for a time, fade in and out. Then sometimes as we look on unawares, the fog lifts, and then there's this web in shimmering beauty reaching past all horizons. We catch our breaths, stretch out our eager hands, and then in comes the fog again, and we go on feeling a little foolish, doubting what we had seen. The hands were right. The web is real. Our follies that we so soon forget.
This is the time in our service where we center ourselves together. We breathe together. And breathing together, we sense one another's loving presence. Breathing in and breathing out, we follow our breath to a deeper place inside, a place of greater wisdom, a place where a spark of the divine resides within each of us. Breathing together, we enter into a time of sacred silence, all the while remembering that nowhere is the world fully silent. Amen, and blessed be. I invite you now to light a candle if you are so moved. Candles representing sorrow, joy, hope, remembrance, resilience, whatever it is you need to honor during this time. As we light candles, I invite you to keep in your mind and heart members of our community who are ill or in sorrow, and those who are celebrating joys. Let us hold the silence together throughout the meditative music. And now we light one last candle for all those for whom there is no one to light a candle. So before I begin, I want to note a couple things. One is that this is a revisitation of an older sermon, which I thought would be quite appropriate because we're in an election year with some new things in it. And also that I'm wearing a red stole and a blue shirt. These are my superhero colors. Several years ago, pre-pandemic, and with great excitement, I went to see the film Wonder Woman. The movie is about the famous comic strip superhero who has been around for generations. Without giving away the plot, just in case you haven't seen it yet or aren't overly familiar with the comic strip, I'll share the story of her origins as portrayed in the movie. Wonder Woman is an Amazon. Yes, those Amazons we have heard about from Greek mythology. Her mother is a queen. They live on Paradise Island with only other women warriors, and she is the only child amongst them. Wonder Woman plays the role of hero and her male sidekick, the damsel in distress. Though many have long thought the Amazons to be only the stuff of legend, more recently archaeologists have confirmed their existence. Or perhaps more accurately, archaeologists have demonstrated the historical existence of the women around whom this famous mythology has arisen. They were Scythian warriors, groupings of nomadic people who lived on the steppes of Eurasia and rode horses millennia ago, perhaps as early as the Bronze Age. They lived in extended family groupings of women, men, and children. About a third of the warriors were female. And their territory included one island off the coast of the Black Sea. Earlier, when the skeletons of these women warriors were first discovered, they were presumed to be men due to the, quote, masculine nature of the grave goods associated with them. It is only with more recent DNA testing that archaeologists realize they were indeed actually women warriors. There is quite a bit of mythology associated with these women, much of which deserves what we call a content warning these days. They were said to have lived with only other women. They were said to have killed their men and male children, or maimed or castrated the young boys. They were said to have been lesbians. They were said to have had only one breast, having cut the other off to better shoot their bows and arrows while riding atop their horses. They were also known to have been heavily tattooed and fond of using marijuana. Much of this mythology arose with the Greeks, who seemed to both fear and admire these women warriors. Some of it was based in what we would call fact. The rest of it in rumor and ill logic. Are you ready for some ill logic? Might have gone something like this. Obviously, no men would ever allow their women to be warriors. Therefore, they must live in groups of only women. Since the women did not live with any men, they must have done something to the men, like kill them. Since the women did have children and women cannot procreate with each other, they must have found other ways to get pregnant, like visiting nearby societies where men did live. Furthermore, since the women did have children, and their offspring would surely be both female and male, the women must have done something to their male children, like kill or maim or castrate them, and so on. So all of this goes to show that we people of the 21st century are not the first victims of fake news. And if you haven't figured it out already, the only scientifically verified facts in the midst of all this fake news, has anyone guessed, are the parts about smoking pot and getting lots of tattoos. That kind of sounds like a prehistoric version of Austin. Today, we live in a post-truth era filled with alternative facts, disinformation, and fake news, not to mention AI chatbots pretending to be customer service reps, and even worse, deep fakes. Yes, they're here. Some of this is not all that new. Before there was fake news, there were hoaxes and propaganda, con artists, some of it even published in what today we would consider more reputable publications. What is new, though, is the speed at which fake news travels, mostly due to social media, and the extremely high quality of deception due to advancing technology. Living in a post-truth era often feels somewhat surreal. This can be underscored when the practice of gaslighting is added to the dissemination of fake news. In the aftermath of the attack in Charlottesville a half dozen years ago, members of the alt-right circulated fake news stories claiming that the person who videotaped the car driving into the crowd was not there by coincidence, but in fact was there as a setup from the left to discredit the neo-Nazis. Let me repeat that. The alt-right claimed that the person who videotaped the car driving into the crowd didn't just happen to be there, but was intentionally planted ahead of time as a setup from the left to discredit the neo-Nazis. It's mind-blowing, isn't it? And it's intentional, but we'll get to that in a little bit. NPR did a news segment a while back on the problems science teachers are having teaching students due to the prevalence of fake news stories that have come into circulation. For example, science teacher Nick Gural says his students believe the Earth is flat. Why? Because a basketball player named Kyrie Irving said so. No matter what the science teacher says, whether simply correcting the students or reasoning with them, they will not change their minds. They believe the Earth is flat. Gural says, they think that I'm part of this larger conspiracy of being a round earther. This is the gaslighting start, right? And other NPR segments describing what teachers are doing to effectively combat fake news, one teacher shared that a student asked the question, "What is news?" Other students asked an NPR reporter if NPR traffics in fake news. And here is the crux of the matter, the paradox. Sam Harris, a well-known atheist and neuroscience, puts it this way. If someone doesn't value evidence, what evidence are you going to provide that prove that they should value it? If someone doesn't value logic, real logic, what logical argument could you provide to show the importance of logic? These are questions that don't have easy answers. So, how did we get here? To this place where facts are not to be believed and science is considered a conspiracy? Well, there are people who study this stuff. Robert Proctor and David Dunning are two of the more well-known figures. And this field of study has a name, agnotology. Agnotology is commonly defined as the study of culturally induced ignorance or doubt. That is, ignorance or doubt purposefully created and spread by people, typically those in power. I say typically because with the advent of social media, those who are otherwise lacking in power now also have the ability to spread ignorance and doubt. Actually, anyone can do this through the power of social media, either intentionally or as unwitting prey to more powerful interests. Jana Rose and Marcos Barros, two professors at the Grenoble School of Management, describe it this way. Agnotology is more than the study of what we don't know. It's also the study of why we are not supposed to know it. One of its more important aspects is revealing how people, usually powerful ones, use ignorance as a strategic tool to hide or divert attention from societal problems in which they have a vested interest. Examples include the tobacco industry spreading doubt about the negative health effects of smoking, as well as conservative think tanks spreading controversy about the science of climate change. So, how can agnotology help us to better understand this world we are now finding ourselves living in? Julian Birkinshaw of the London School Business School Review cautions us that in attempting to understand our political climate, we shouldn't mix up cause and effect. Contempt for expert advice is what created the Trump bandwagon, not vice versa, as well as Brexit and other things like that. I'll repeat that. Contempt for expert advice causes bandwagons. Bandwagons or their leaders don't cause contempt for expert advice. Birkinshaw tells us that there are two distinct tens, two distinct trends that are shaping our understanding of the world. The first is that humans are becoming stupider. If stupider is measured relative to all of the world's collective knowledge. So we're talking proportionally, right? Humans are becoming stupider. So in other words, while our IQs have actually risen a bit, they have not kept pace with exponential growth in humankind's collective knowledge. He says the gap between what each of us knows and what the world knows is growing rapidly. The second trend Birkinshaw sees is that business and politics are growing more and more interdependent, and the effects of one on the other can be rather unpredictable. The global economy is a complex system, and he says it is a strange paradox of our times. The more we connect, the harder it is for us to predict. The more we connect, the harder it is for us to predict. Over these past 8 or so years, I have engaged in so many, many conversations with people about what is going on in our world. Feelings of cynicism, pessimism, hopelessness, and despair about the state of the world seem to be on the rise. People are struggling to understand how we have come to be in this place where, among other things, vast numbers of people vote to put in office someone who is in direct opposition to their own self-interest. Julian Birkinshaw has the best explanation I have seen about how and why this happens, so I'm going to share an extended quote from him. Here it goes. Put these two points together. As individuals, we are struggling to understand the present, and it is getting harder to predict the future. The result is a form of cognitive dissonance. As thoughtful beings, we like to be in control, but increasingly, we cannot. So how do we resolve this dissonance? We fall back on belief, on our own intuition. This is a scary point. It is human nature to jump straight to a judgment, often on the basis of the slenderest of facts. And, paradoxically, the more complex and uncertain the issue, the more we tend to trust our intuition. If asked a complex question like, do you support leaving the European Union? The reasoning-based part of your brain goes into meltdown, and the intuitive part takes over. While this tendency to lead to judgment has always existed, it has become a bigger problem as individuals become relatively ignorant and less able to see what's coming next. Technology then exacerbates the problem with our Facebook and Twitter, now known as X, feeds, spreading news that is often completely devoid of facts. And smart politicians are quick to exploit the trend, tapping into our intuition and subconscious beliefs rather than boring us with hard evidence. Emotion beats logic in the art of persuasion, a point that the Brexiteers and the Trump campaign understood very well. Here ends the quote. That was written while Trump was in office and before the insurrection. Emotions beat logic. Our brains go into meltdown. Our intuition takes over. We fall back on belief. I'll repeat that. When faced with increasingly complex issues, emotions beat logic. Our brains go into meltdown. Our intuition takes over. We fall back on belief. We are literally overwhelmed with information. And then we become susceptible to fake news, alternative facts, and disinformation, which in turn overwhelms us. Robert Proctor sums it up best. We live in a world of radical ignorance, and the marvel is that any kind of truth cuts through the noise. In one of the earlier scenes of the movie Wonder Woman, our superhero discovers that her new sidekick, the first male she has ever seen, has been deceiving her. She then wonders aloud how she would know if he is deceiving her again. Now, her solution? She wraps her lasso around him and squeezes the truth right out. Unlike in Wonder Woman, none of us has a lasso of truth. But there are things we can do to protect ourselves and our children from a vast ocean of deception, which could be a whole nother sermon, but among them, making use of websites like Snopes and PolitiFact and Fact Check. So like the man on the beach tossing starfish back into the ocean, one by one by one, we face daunting odds. It would be easy for any of us to feel overwhelmed and lose hope in this post-truth era. But like him and the writer who joined him, we can keep hope alive by making a difference for this one, by debunking this myth, by teaching this child to think critically, by stopping the spread of this piece of fake news, and by not tolerating the intolerant, by not tolerating this hate group, by not tolerating this act of intimidation, by not tolerating this symbol of racist ideology. It is time in this post-truth era to live into the paradoxes of contemporary life and stop wasting energy railing against them. Verbally, I don't mean not do anything. I mean stop spending the emotional energy railing against what is. We can get into a lot of Buddhism here, actually, with non-attachment and attachment. When you're attached to the idea that logic should rule and it doesn't, you suffer, right? So non-attachment is what I'm talking about. And we can look for reasons to hope. We can find reasons to hope in the UU congregations up north who are helping to pay for families who are relocating from states like ours where trans kids are not safe. They're bringing their kids to other places and helping to support financially people and find houses and things like that. We can be symbols of hope to each other. It's not all one thing that we're talking about. I mean, it is all one thing that we're talking about, not many separate things. It's the web, right? The interdependent web. It is both and, not A but B. It is the individual starfish and the ocean. It's just that we usually see each piece of the interdependent web separately, except in those precious few moments when the fog rolls away and our hand reaches out for the truth. May we see truth more clearly and hold hope more dearly. Amen, and blessed be.
Today we have closing words from Cherish Your Doubts by the Reverend Dr. Michael A. Schuller. Cherish your doubts, for doubt is the servant of truth. Question your convictions, for beliefs too tightly held strangle the mind and its natural wisdom. Suspect all certitudes, for the world whirls on, nothing abides. Yet in our inner rooms full of doubt, inquiry, and suspicion, let a corner be reserved for trust. For without trust, there is no space for communities to gather or for friendships to be forged. Indeed, this is the small corner where we connect and reconnect with each other. Please join me in reading the words for extinguishing the chalice. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we hold in our hearts until we are together again.
Now, may the love of truth guide you, the warmth of love hold you, and the spirit of peace bless you this day and in the days to come. May we say together, Amen, amen. And blessed be.
This is a production of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, go to our website at austinuu.org.